88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. I'm Duncan Strauss. Really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with Dr. Denise Herzing, who's done pioneering research studying Atlantic spotted dolphins over 27 years, including a breakthrough that may involve two-way communication between dolphins and humans. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Meg Hutchinson with Seeing Stars here on Talking Animals.
Bugs out on the water make it look like rain. Leaves on every tree once again turning. Summer's past, but it's never far. If you look real close, you might see scars with me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Evening light on a gravel path. Could be scared, but I've had enough of that old big old moon rising up. Even in this light, you might see scars with me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. When they take everything you got, nothing left, a deer in the headlights, in a hospital bed, just dreaming of a simple life, a gentleman, a solid night, me and the dog down at the reservoir. If you look real close, you might see scars with me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Oh. Seems all your songs are about leaving. Seems both your hands are about now. Geese up in the sky, home through the dark. If you look real close, you might see scars with me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars.
That's Meg Hutchinson with Seeing Stars, an animal song, a dog song she played live on Flea Show Monday. Sounded great, so why not play it today? Tease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. I see no reason at all. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Denise Herzing, a pioneering researcher who has spent 27 summers in Bahamian waters studying Atlantic spotted dolphins and is considered the world's leading authority on the species. Her work tracking three generations of the same dolphin families, entitled the Wild Dolphin Project, has elicited comparisons with the work of Jane Goodall. We'll discuss various aspects of the Wild Dolphin Project, including being on the cusp of achieving a major breakthrough in fostering two-way communication between humans and dolphins. And we speak with Dr. Denise Herzing in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a Talking Animals coffee mug in which everything tastes just a little bit better. And we'll speak briefly with Cindy Sperber-Doty, founder of Adopt a New Leash on Life, a new social networking page devoted to matching up immediately adoptable dogs Florida-wide with Forever Homes, underscoring the do not buy message. Right now, though, it's time for Animal News and Announcements segment. Look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. Produced by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department, our first item may sort of only peripherally relate to Talking Animals, but it has its connections. First of all, it deals with Mark Maron, in a way, whose celebrated podcast, WTF, touted on the show, and he's been a past guest on the show. He's a huge cat guy, and he conducts those podcast interviews from the so-called Cat Ranch out in Southern California. And as I've said a number of times, for my money, one of the best interviewers really across any medium. So it's mostly comedians, but the topics reach far and wide and often deep, which brings me to Monday. And the guest was Todd Glass, and back when I was a talent manager eons ago, one of my clients was Todd, who I also played on the Comedy Corner. He's got some animal comedy himself. Anyways, hilarious, adventurous comic, great, great guy. Anyways, on Monday's WTF, Todd came out, officially revealing he's gay, and it's a brave, poignant conversation that's made kind of national news in various ways, and anyways, I recommend it, as I do any edition of WTF, really, which you can find by going to WTFpod.com. All right, tracking as we do what's happening with the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and the current campaign in the Antarctic Ocean. This came courtesy of Sean Canan, our Assistant News and Public Affairs Director. Dateline Canberra, Australia. An anti-whaling group says three of its members suffered minor injuries when they attempted to slow a Japanese harpoon boat in the Antarctic Ocean. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society says the Japanese crew threw grappling hooks on Wednesday when activists approached in two inflatable powerboats in a bid to prevent the whaler from tailing the group's flagship, the Steve Irwin. The statement says two activists sustained bruises from the hooks and a third was cut on the face by a bamboo pole thrust from the Japanese deck. An Inuit spokesman for the whale hunt sponsors say the Japanese were retrieving a rope the activists had cast in a failed bid to snag the whaler's propeller. Inuit says if activists were injured, it's because they came too close. You've listened to the show regularly for any length of time. You know that we've talked many ways from many different angles about the pending tethering ordinance in Hillsborough County. And so just want to let you know a couple things about that. One is I want to remind you that the ordinance will be voted on by Hillsborough County Commissioners this Thursday, as in tomorrow, January 19th at 2 p.m. in the County Center Building, second floor, boardroom, 601 East Kennedy Boulevard, Tampa, 33602, if you're map blasting, Google mapping, whatever. And anyway, so I really, if you have any ability to get over there and sort of urge your support for this. Again, this is the here's another thing that sort of want to mention in the same breath practically, is that I noticed that I think it was last night that I found it, but I think it appears probably in today's edition of the Tampa Bay Times, but there was an editorial and in support of this ordinance. In other words, the headline says, Stand for Animal Welfare Bans Tethering, and I believe, again, that it appears in print in today's edition of the Tampa Bay Times. It was online last night. But anyway, again, this quickly just deals with preventing folks from just tying up or chaining up their dogs for, incredibly long periods of time and making them vulnerable to weather, predators, other things, getting caught up and tangled in the chain or the rope, just any number of awful things. So, again, many, many counties across the country and even adjacent counties have just such an anti-tethering ordinance. So we do hope that the Hillsborough County Commissioners will vote to adopt the tethering ordinance before them tomorrow, 2 o'clock. So get out there and check with me if you have any questions about the turning up at the meeting. Want some other details that you didn't quite hear now. Found this by way of New York Daily News. Animal welfare experts are trying to figure out what's causing dozens of dolphins to get stranded on the beaches in Cape Cod this month. A whopping 59 dolphins have been found on shore as of Tuesday, experts say. Of those 59, rescuers have been able to release 19 back in the water. Harry Brandon of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, which oversees the rescues, told the Daily News. Experts said the sheer number of dolphins stranding is unusual, even for an area that has seen dolphins wash ashore for centuries. Quote, I've been doing this for 15 years, and this is the second season I've seen it like this. Katie Moore, manager of the International Fund for Animal Welfare's Marine Mammal Rescue and Research Program, told the Boston Globe. Brandon said the animals were probably just following along with the pack. Dolphins, she said, are social animals who tend to stick together even when one of them is sick or injured. So maybe we'll ask Dr. Herzing about this, and we certainly will hear shortly from her just how social they are in the wild. Coming up again locally, I want to let you know that on February 4th, Nathan Winograd is a national author and very prominent animal advocate known for his innovative ways to end the killing of healthy adoptable animals. And this event is called Save 90 because national studies show that 90% of animals entering shelters are healthy and adoptable. So that'll be again Saturday, February 4th. Currently, the venue for that talk is the Tampa Tribune Auditorium, but it may well change. There's so much interest in this topic, and again, so much interest in hearing Nathan Winograd speak, that I think movement is afoot to move it to a larger venue. So we'll keep you posted on that, and you can go to save90.org for more information to see about getting into the event. And meanwhile, Nathan Winograd will be our guest on Talking Animals February 1st, a few days before this event on February 4th. Again, it's save90.org. In Defense of Animals, just released its annual 10 Worst Zoos for Elephant list. And without getting into all the description, I'll just run them down quickly. Number one, Edmonton Valley Zoo, Alberta, Canada. Number two, Reed Park Zoo, Tucson, Arizona. Number three, Buttonwood Park Zoo, Massachusetts. Number four, Topeka Zoo, Kansas. Number five, Niabe Zoo, Coal Valley, Illinois. Number six, St. Louis Zoo in Missouri. Number seven, Little Rock Zoo in Arkansas. Number eight, Columbus Zoo in Ohio. Number nine, Wildlife Safari in Winston, Oregon. And number 10, Honolulu Zoo in Hawaii. So anyway, you can find out more about going if you'd like to get the details and some of the descriptions and why and who moved up and down the list and why. And just search for In Defense of Animals, Worst Zoos for Elephants, 2011. It's just the last few weeks, but just now we're in the midst of it. But I want to remind you, too, that Sue Pike, who is a regular presence on E-Love's show and has been on Talking Animals in the past. She's a so-called animal talker. Anyway, she is in the midst now of a visit to the Tampa Clearwater area doing various training sessions and other events. So to find out more on what's left, the dates she's already started. They were started January 14th, but they go through the 22nd. So if you'd like to find out more, you can just go to SuePikeEnergy.com. All right. We have time. We'll come back to some others. But right now, I think it's time to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy, as always. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece of... With a piece of cetacean-oriented comedy relevant to our imminent conversation with Dr. Herzing called Talk to the Animals on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
But, you know, whales, they're intelligent. They do whale song. We don't know what it means, but I think that whales are traveling at 78. They're traveling at 78 speed, and if we take them up to 45 speed, we'll find they're actually going, I love you, baby, and if it's quite all right, I love you, baby, well, then I love you, baby, question me, well, I love you, Yeah, they're DJs, you see. DJs of the sea. Because sound travels well in water, and they need a big PA to be a DJ, but they've got their whole bodies. Yeah, it works, doesn't it? This next song is going out to all the goldfish down by the Azores. I love you, baby. So they're intelligent, and dolphins, they're intelligent, because we all saw the documentary Flipper. Well, dolphins came up going, what's that? What's that, Flip? Chiang Kai-shek is having trouble. Mao Tse-tung is taking over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek has retired to Taiwan with some of his followers, where they will have a complete disregard for international copyright rules. Is that what you're saying, Flip, or do you want fish? Because every episode of Flipper, he'd say the same thing. Always having a problem. What's that? What? A boy trapped in a well, trapped in the water. Three boys fell out of a ship, a small ship, a big ship. Two syllables. Big ship, small ship. Sounds like the deep. Bit like the deep, bit of the shark. Jaws, da na na na, like that. What? Gone with the wind. Okay. And they were all like that. There was Skippy. Yeah. What's that, Skip? A boy trapped, drowning in a desert. Drowning in the desert, in a desert. Ill. He's in a sandy place. He's ill. He's got a bad leg. What? Gone with the wind? And Lassie as well. What? You know, all Lassie, Flippy, Skippy, all that E sound. Except for Flipper.
All right. That was Eddie Izzard. The piece called Talk to the Animals, taken from his album Circle. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Dr. Denise Herzing. As I outlined earlier in the show, Dr. Herzing's Wild Dolphin Project has spanned 27 years studying Atlantic spotted dolphins in the Bahamas and yielded a host of significant results, not least that Dr. Herzing is on the cusp of fostering two-way communication between humans and dolphins. So today we'll be discussing talking animals, sort of, among other subjects. Dr. Herzing is also the author of the recent book, Dolphin Diaries, My 25 Years with Spotted Dolphins in the Bahamas. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Denise Herzing to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Herzing.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and lots to cover and lots to sort of cram into a small space, so let's get to it. Now, so, coming to the Denise Herzing story, through any means, your book, newspaper profiles, your own telling of it, et cetera, one can't help but be struck by sort of the powerful storylines of ambition and vision, even in your formative years in sort of decidedly landlocked St. Cloud, Minnesota. For those listeners who may not yet be familiar with that story, maybe you could give us the nickel tour of those early years and what first fascinated you about dolphins, even as a child.
Well, yeah, honestly, I was just one of those nerdy kids who used to page through the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I would always stop at the whale and dolphin page, and I would always wonder, what are they doing with these big, complex minds in the water? You know, we knew about primates, we knew about elephants, but, you know, here are dolphins, the, you know, equivalent, basically, of a big-brained social mammal in the water, and you know, nobody was really studying them, you know, in that kind of detail. And sort of simultaneously, Jacques Cousteau came out on the TV, and so I was like, wow, the underwater world is really explored, and that just set me on a path of marine biology and focusing on dolphin communication.
And we'll get into all kinds of specifics along the way, perhaps somewhat out of chronology, who knows. But early in the book, for example, you write, I wanted to study dolphins like Jane Goodall had studied chimpanzees. I mean, what did at that point when you were sort of just launching your career, what did Jane Goodall mean to you? What were the chief ways that she influenced you back then?
Well, you know, first of all, she was in the wild. And, you know, really the options in my days, anyway, were to study dolphins in captivity for the most part. But, you know, Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey, of course, with gorillas, and Cynthia Moss with elephants, they had all showed us that if you go plant yourself in the animal's environment and try to be relatively benign and habituate them to your presence so they're not afraid of you, that you could eventually observe the details of their society. So, you know, not only were they women, but they were just planting, they went out for 20 years and planted themselves where the animals, you know, manifest their qualities of, you know, their society and intelligence. So those were really my models.
Yeah. And so now, more than 25 years later, having sort of carved out your own illustrious career, you know, using those models, I mean, what does, you know, Jane Goodall and you know, Cynthia Moss and those folks mean to you now? I mean, do you sort of look at them through a different prism just because of, you know, what you've done? And obviously there's been some fairly rigorous years to get to where we're talking today.
Well, you know, of course, like I said, they were the models for the work. I mean, they remain the pioneers that really, you know, pioneered that method of observation and really showed us that you could see intimate details of a non-human society if you just spent a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, and now with dolphins, that's really difficult. You know, there really aren't many places in the world where one could plant oneself to observe them doing their behavior, which primarily happens underwater. I mean, there's plenty of places to look at them from the surface, but I really wanted to see how they spend their time underwater in detail.
Yeah. Well, and just I want to get into that in one sec, but I just was struck somewhere else in the book, now that we're talking, I remember that you know, were at a lecture many years later that Jane Goodall was giving, and I think you asked, like, how she felt in retrospect about the technique, and it just, you know, she felt like, hey, that's what was necessary to study them and learn what I learned, and that seemed like that was also important to you.
Well, you know, as humans, we have to be, and even as scientists, we should be really careful about interacting with wild animals. I mean, for example, in the United States, you know, we have very strict laws to protect animals from too much people interaction because we can bombard them. You know, and even as a scientist, I was concerned about, you know, am I going to disrupt their lives too much? You know, are there diseases that are transmittable? I mean, these are all issues that these researchers dealt with in the wild with their terrestrial species. But again, you know, we need the information to understand the complexity. So, you know, I was hoping that would be worth it. So yeah, that was, of course, a concern as far as the ethics of it.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's get into this, the Wild Elephant Project. So, for instance, for people who may not be as familiar with it or haven't had a chance to read your book, why the Bahamas, for starters?
Well, I was looking for some place in the world where I could observe these animals underwater, and circumstances had provided me a glimpse with Hardy Jones, who had actually been out in the Bahamas and had some footage of these wild dolphins, and I had seen it on TV, actually. And I was like, wow, is anybody out there where you can see underwater?
Yeah.
So basically, the Bahamas is a very unique place for multiple reasons. First of all, you can see most of the time with good clarity underwater. Secondly, the animals seem to be semi-interested in people, at least on their terms, you know, when they have time. And really, it was those two elements that, you know, made it seem like a good potential place. And it took a few years to figure out that it was.
And it also, but even then it seemed like, because, I mean, one of the things that does come up a lot in your story and, in fact, of course, in your book is multiple references to, like, almost from the get-go. And again, maybe this goes back to what we just discussed in terms of Jane Goodall and Cynthia Moss, et cetera. But it seemed like you always knew that, hey, if I'm going to do this, I got to be here at least 20 years.
Yeah, well, you know, dolphins are long-lived mammals. You know, I figured if I wanted to observe 2 to 3 generations, that would be their cycle. You know, it takes about 10 years for them to get sexually mature. So I figured I would plant myself and really focus on, you know, one group if they would allow it, and see if we could see, you know, grandmothers and grandfathers and grandkids growing up and all the details of a complex society.
Sure. Well, so, okay, so the focus of the Wild Dolphin Project, again, has been Atlantic spotted dolphins. Maybe you could just sort of briefly describe them, perhaps in contrast to bottlenose dolphins that folks may immediately more likely picture when someone says dolphins.
Sure. Well, there are about 30 species of what you would consider dolphins, small toothed dolphin-like beings. We know most about bottlenose dolphins for two reasons, because they're primarily in captivity and they're often close to shore, so researchers have pretty good access to them in many parts of the world. Atlantic spotted dolphins are unique to the Atlantic. You would not find them, for example, in the Pacific or anywhere else except the Atlantic basin. And they're, they're a little smaller than bottlenose dolphins. They don't have spots when they're born, so they kind of look like little bottlenose calves. But as they grow up, they gain spots with age, which is one way we can classify their ages. I mean, although we know the individuals, so we actually know their real ages. But if, like, for example, I go to another study site that has spotted dolphins, I could jump in the water, even look from the bow and say, oh, that animal's probably between, 4 and 8 years old based on their degree of spotting. So they're a nice species to study just from that standpoint, because they have very clear developmental periods with their ages. So that has been a big boost for our study of their behavior.
Cool. All right. Well, let me let folks know again, if you just tuned in, this is Talking Animals. We're speaking with Dr. Denise Herzing, who's been studying Atlantic spotted dolphins in the Bahamas for the better part of 27 summers. An effort called the Wild Dolphin Project. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Dr. Herzing a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So let's talk a bit about what etiquette means in the long-term study of animals, for example, Atlantic spotted dolphins, and why it's so important in the kind of study and the kind of work that you've been doing.
Sure. Well, because we work in the water, and you can't really build an underwater blind like you might, on land, for example, to observe an animal. We really had to place ourselves in their environment, but we wanted to try to not hide ourselves, but be, as least invasive as we could. So the idea was that we wanted to behave ourselves according to dolphin etiquette, which, and I learned the hard way quite a few things, what not to do, when to do things, how to swim, that sort of thing. So the idea was to, number one, acknowledge that we were aware of some of their rules and we were going to try to obey them and behave ourselves as humans in the water. And that really allowed us to, again, spend hours and hours very close to the dolphins and to watch what they're doing without disturbing them.
Cool. And one of the things that I guess came out of that is dolphins probably have a lot more sex than most of us realize, or heck, than most of us are having. No wonder wild dolphins seem so happy. But more to the point, I guess you really sort of get the sense of the richness of dolphin lives, and you describe the ritualized courtship and how the lives of dolphins, female dolphins in particular, really change when they enter the reproductive phase and raising the calves and babysitting. And to me, these things are, of course, so fascinating, and yet it's hard not to be, as a little, hopefully brief detour, sad in new and different ways about dolphins in captivity, because you think, well, of course, they're deprived of virtually all these experiences and the information that's transferred from their friends and relatives and babysitters. And but it was, again, just sort of a even for those of you who think we know a little bit about dolphins, it was kind of a revelation to really get into all the stuff that happens day to day in the dolphin families.
Well, that's part of the importance of studying them in the wild, where they evolved and where they live out their lives. I mean, we do have a certain image of dolphins from, the marine parks over the years, because they can only present a certain part of the animal, how they can jump and their sensory systems and that sort of thing. And it's been, it has been a real awareness through many research projects, not just mine, research projects that work in the wild about the complexities, and they're, we have to remember they really are social mammals. They're social mammals like primates are and like we are and like elephants are. They have these complicated lives and they have a continuum of behavior. Yes, they can have fun and they play and they frolic and they have friendships and all that, but they fight. They have the other end. They fight, they compete, they're jealous, they have politics. But that's the whole point, is that they really are a parallel species in the water. And so they do have these complex life stages and life things to deal with, including learning how to babysit, for example, or learning how to fish. It's not just, born with this. They depend on their relatives and associates. And, I mean, that's the real importance of being a social mammal.
Okay, so Dr. Zimri, I've got a bunch of things I want to ask, but there's already been a flood of a flood of emails and at least one call. Let's try to work at least one of these in. This says, hi, thank you for your work. Has the population of your dolphins been affected by the Gulf oil spill or storms in the Bahamas?
Very good question. Yes, in 2004, well, we have hurricanes every year, but they don't always hit the Bahamas, and even if they do, they don't always hit our study site. We did have a couple major hurricanes go through the Bahamas in 2004 and 5. I talk about this in my book pretty extensively.
Right.
Because actually we lost about, surprisingly, about 30% of both our spotted dolphins and bottlenose, who also live out there. Much to my surprise, since they were a healthy, you know, natural, you know, society for the most part. They have restabilized. We have not found any of the individuals we lost, so we're pretty sure they probably died in the storm or secondarily. Now, the Gulf oil spill was originally projected to come around the tip of Florida and go up into the Bahamas, and we were monitoring for it because we were out there all that the summer after the April event. And as far as we know, the oil didn't reach there. We don't have any information that it did, nor did we see any, you know, obvious correlation with it. But it could have been a huge concern. It could have completely wiped out our small group, actually.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm glad to hear you say you were kind of surprised, because when I read that in the book about the impact, I mean, we're all impacted by hurricanes if you live in Florida or the Bahamas or whatever, but I was surprised the extent to which the dolphins were impacted. I just somehow figured, they would be better protected or find ways to be better protected during those things. So,
well, it's a hard thing to get away from a 500-mile wide storm, for one.
Yeah, for sure.
And the part of the unique issue during that hurricane season was that the first hurricane, Hurricane Francis, actually went stationary. It just stopped moving. And so it hovered over their area for about 36 hours, and you can imagine these, you know, 30 to 40-foot waves and water in the air, and, you know, dolphins breathe air, and it's probably very chaotic, so probably just from exhaustion. And
yeah.
If the hurricane would have moved through, it might not have impacted them that much. At least that would be my guess.
Okay.
But it was quite a unique formula.
It hung there, yeah.
You know?
All right, so Dr. Herzing, just so I want to be really careful that we don't run short of time on talking about something that I think is obviously as important as anything else that we might discuss today. And of course, I'm referring to two-way communication and some of the work that you've done. And there's I think some emailers that have questions about that. So maybe you could just sort of outline, you know, what that involves and your study, how that shifted and how your approach has shifted and sort of what maybe kind of right on the cusp as we speak.
Sure. Well, first of all, primarily what we do with the dolphins underwater is we passively record their own communication signals. So, for example, one of my main tools is an underwater video with a hydrophone. Correlate sound and behavior. So that's been a main body of our work for the last 20 plus. So we know, for example, certain sounds are associated with certain behaviors, certain whistles are associated with certain individual dolphins. So we have a catalog of that. You know, we have a little, it's not a vocabulary, but we have a list of the types of sounds, a repertoire of what sounds they make and what behaviors, et cetera. Now, what occurred to us, really, was that how interested the dolphins were really in us, some detail, and they would mimic our postures and spend time with us and play games with us. And, you know, the history of two-way interfaces is not new. You know, people have tried communicating with other species, and there's been some great successes with parrots and primates, for example. Dolphins, it's been a little iffy. And, you know, the other thing that has changed now is we really have not only an understanding of the dolphins, society, and communication more. But now we have some technology that really allows us to do some pretty creative things, such as do real-time sound matching, record data on computers that tell us what animals are doing with a technological interface, for example. And one of the best examples of that was actually up at Epcot Center in Orlando at Disney World. They had a lovely underwater keyboard for years and actually tried a very creative approach to letting the dolphins request things with a keyboard, which is really the technique, you know, that has been used with primates and birds and
mm-hmm.
other species. So in our situation, of course, we're in the wild, so we have all these extra elements like weather and, you know, seeing animals on a regular basis, that sort of thing. But what we thought was, well, you know, maybe we could do a very rudimentary interface and give them control of a few things and see if they wanted to request certain toys or certain individuals. And you know, it's partly it's a way to study their own communication system, and partly it's a way to understand their cognitive abilities. And we know from captive work that they have incredible abilities to learn other systems of communication. For example, you know, sign language and some acoustic systems. We know they're capable of it. We just don't know if they do that with each other and if they would do it in the wild, you know.
Sure.
But if anywhere it could happen, it'd probably be, you know, out where we are. And so basically we've been designing an interface. We tried some work in the late 90s with a physical keyboard. But, you know, because they're wild dolphins, they don't touch things, you know, naturally, at least the keyboard. So we've gone back to the idea of an acoustic interface so we could work real time with them with sound in the water. And the idea is just to explore whether they'd be interested in using a system of sounds to request things from us or not. And we're going to go from there.
And so, Dr. Herzing, what are the implications? I mean, in a way, as I was reading your book, it almost, like whether you're consciously doing it or not, you're sort of almost waiting or just turned up to this way for technology to kind of catch up with, you know, what had, you know, would work based on what was already been sort of had fallen short in those efforts. But meanwhile, what are the implications of being able to communicate directly with dolphins? I mean, not just obviously, hey, if you jump through this hoop on my command, I'll give you a fish, but true communication, true conversation in both directions. I mean, it's you know, the idea, at least to me, is thrilling, but what does it really mean?
Well, for one thing, I think it takes us out of the, yeah, we can train animals. We know that. We can train humans, too, you know, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of empowering another species through technology that potentially, in the case of dolphins at least, bridges a sensory gap. You know, for example, they're not going to speak English words and they don't have hands, you know, so
right.
How do you do that? Well, maybe go into their world a little bit and try to bridge a gap and give them some tools that are mutually accessible between species. So, you know, I think the implications are it opens up the idea that, hey, you know, there might be some other sentient creatures on the planet. We might learn a lot from how other species communicate both to each other and, you know, across species lines, which they do with each other, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, animals are way ahead of us. They already can understand and work in another species system to a certain extent. So there's precedent already. And they do it because they have to. You know, necessity is the mother, as they say.
Yeah.
So if they have to learn another animal's alarm signal, for example, to survive, then they're going to do that. You know, they have these abilities. So, you know, I think the implications are pretty interesting. I mean, I don't think we're going to have a detailed conversation. This is not about
yeah.
a translator or a conversation.
Sure.
It's about exploring where they may take it.
Mm-hmm.
And could we evolve something more complex? You know, it's possible.
Yeah. Well, one thing, too, and I think you, you know, just in the ensuing conversation, Pierre, this email came in a few minutes ago, but, and clearly somebody probably who's either not read the book or just not that familiar with the work, but the question simply says, hasn't Dr. John Lilly already done most of this research?
Well, John Lilly was a neuroscientist in the late 60s, 70s. You know, he tried a lot of different things. But again, you know, we didn't really know about dolphins. The technology certainly was not really well developed at that time. And, you know, although Lilly was quite a visionary, he really kind of went off other than doing science and really didn't publish much. He didn't show anything. I mean, he tried some things, but honestly, it was premature.
You know, yeah.
It was premature for the technology. It was premature as far as the approach he used. I mean, for example, he was trying to get dolphins to mimic English words. They can't do it
yeah.
physically, nor can chimpanzees, for example. They don't have the vocal apparatus in the oral cavity that we do that allow us to make complicated words. So, you know, anytime you're asking an animal to do something they can't, of course you're going to have failure, and the animal will be frustrated, you'll be frustrated. So, yes, he had the vision, but, you know, he kind of, you know, he went off into, you know, drug land and did a little too much, you know, exploring of his own mind, and he really lost his scientific stability to a certain extent, but he was still a visionary. You
yeah.
know? And I think now the technology is there and our understanding of some of their complexity is quite different than it was back then. And I think it's worth another, you know, shot at this point.
For sure. And again, I should note just generally and maybe more directly to the emailer who raised this question that again, the, first of all, Dr. Herzing's book is called Dolphin Diaries, My 25 Years with Spotted Dolphins in the Bahamas. And one of the, I think one of the many sort of, you know, wonderful things about the book is that you freely acknowledge and credit, you know, people who came before you, including Dr. Lilly. I mean, early on, I think it's in the first few pages of the book, if I recall, you acknowledge him and say, you know, yeah, he was controversial, but also maybe just sort of a visionary that was before his time or something to that effect, in exploring two-way communication. So, you know, like anything in this realm, I mean, what you're doing has been, you know, building on and hopefully improving upon stuff that people did earlier on, and either they veered off in another direction or had, you know, again, limited maybe technology to sort of fully realize what they thought they could explore. And, you know, you really seem to really trace a line, you know, from all the folks that hook into what you've been doing.
Well, you know, the reality is science is a process. You know, sometimes we learn from our failures. In fact, more than not, we learn from our failures. And, you know, we have limited time with limited technology in our, you know, lifetimes. And I'm sure someone down the road after I'm gone is going to take off and develop some of the cool tools that could be potentially used for, you know, all sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is you want to check yourself, and that's why the scientific process requires things like, you know, that you publish your work and that you go under criticism and that you show, well, we think this was going on, but was it really, and how can we look at it differently? You know, the actual problem that Lilly's work created more than anything was that he went so far out to make claims that he turned off scientists from continuing to explore this area, at least that's my opinion, and people have been afraid to be labeled, you know, doing two-way work, although at the same time, you know, other species have been explored using two-way systems and interfaces. So, you know, I've been kind of surprised that no one's really developed an interface on a serious level to really say, hey, it's time to look at this again. If nothing else, just to see how the dolphins would explore such a technology interface. So, you know, that can happen in science, too.
Sure. So we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. Herzing, but let me ask you this. So am I right in sort of thinking or just trying to put together various pieces of the Dr. Herzing puzzle that very possibly from where you are, technology, et cetera, and all the research leading up to this point, that this coming summer might sort of yield the breakthrough in the two-way communication, or is that sort of putting too much pressure on?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? But
yeah.
This summer, we've been working about 2 years. I've been working with colleagues at Georgia Tech in Atlanta who are build wearable computers and do some pretty neat pattern recognition software work, and we've been working for the last couple of years trying to get both the hardware in place and the software to do what we want to do, and this summer will be the first time we'll actually have the first version of that really in the water to try with the animals. We actually had the hardware out last year just to test that without the animals. But
yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see. And we, you know, we may come back from the end of summer and go, oh man, they weren't interested, they didn't do anything, we have to rethink this, or they may have explored it, and we'll just have to see how it works. But we're going to go slow and start simple. And
it's, I think, no small statement or understatement to say it's an ongoing saga, as it has been for 27-plus years. But anyways, this has been Dr. Denise Herzing. Her book, which just came out last year, and obviously really chock full of all this information and more, Dolphin Diaries, My 25 Years with Spotted Dolphins in the Bahamas. And the website for the Wild Dolphin Project is simply wilddolphinproject.org, and they're also on Facebook. So, Dr. Herzing, thank you again for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals mug, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, not unrelated to our conversation a moment ago with Dr. Herzing. And in a moment, though, we'll chat with Cindy Sperber Doty, founder of Adopt a New Leash on Life. Right now, though, let's name that animal tune on Talking Animals. All right. We do have, looks like a few folks who might know. Let's quickly take them, and then we'll speak with Cindy Spurridotti. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Is that the Flipper theme song?
It is indeed. Sort of a gimme, but that's what we like to do sometimes here on Talking Animals. What is your first name, sir?
Paul.
Okay, it is, and that's going to get you your very own Talking Animals coffee mug. Where, again, everything tastes just a little bit better. So if you don't mind, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll come back and get your information just as soon as I can to send that to you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for listening.
Yep.
All right, we do have a winner, folks. And now let's welcome Cindy Spurridotti to Talking Animals. Cindy, hello.
Hello, Duncan. Good morning. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So let's jump right in. What is Adopt a New Leash on Life, other than just a great bit of wordplay?
It was a great bit of wordplay, but yeah. There are three of us involved in this group. We have been involved in the rescue community for many years. And what we want to do is make the general public aware of dogs that are available in rescue. They know to go to shelters, they know to go to pounds, but most people in general public don't know about rescues and dogs that are placed in foster. So we started a Facebook page where Florida rescues are allowed to post available dogs, and all of the rescue groups get together and post their dogs and their information about the dogs, and we're trying to get the general public to know about it because it's a wonderful opportunity. The rescue community works together, and we know what's available, but people as a rule don't know about foster dogs, which are just wonderful. You know, dogs don't end up in shelters usually because they're perfect animals. So when a rescue takes in an animal, we evaluate them. We know whether they're good with other dogs, cats. We work with professional trainers that volunteer with our group so that when that dog leaves the rescue, we know that dog has made a perfect match for a family.
So let me ask you this, Cindy. What can anyone post? And sort of a related question, what's the criteria for posting?
The criteria is basically the same criteria that most rescue use. All dogs must be spay-neutered.
Okay.
They must be up-to-date on their vaccinations. And they need to have some sort of a personality temperament evaluation so that when a family goes in to look for a dog and they have other dogs or cats, they know that specific animal won't have a problem adjusting to it.
Okay. And so I guess one question that comes to my mind, may come to other people's minds who are listening, is what would be different about Adopt a New Leash on Life and its Facebook page than other, you know, various rescues that have their own Facebook page that are also trying to present adoptable dogs?
Another avenue.
So it's just an additional way to sort of collect and present ones. And I gather from information I think I saw that the key thing here too is that these dogs are immediately adoptable. Like they
exactly.
do meet that criteria, and boom, if somebody wanted to grab that Rover today, if they met the criteria,
Duncan,
they could.
Duncan, let me add that some rescues are breed specific. You know, they may do just collies, or they may just do golden retrievers.
Right.
They may just do pit bulls. So this allows multiple dogs. And I must say this, too, is that numerous times some of the shelters get breed or breed mixes wrong, whereas when they go into rescue, we pretty much have a good idea as to what the mix is or the breed. And so there's going to be more specifics there, and we're not competing with rescue. We're working with rescues because, you know, if someone called me yesterday and said, I want a golden retriever and I don't have one, I know where to go. So the general public doesn't know that. So it gives them a place that they can post as well and say, hey, you know, I'm looking for a golden retriever. Does someone know? And, you know, four rescues will jump in. So
sure.
It's more for the public. It gives rescue another alternative to post. But we want to get it out to the general public who is unaware that hundreds of these dogs are literally sitting in foster care.
Sure. And again, so it sounds like it's sort of a It crosses Breathe, it crosses rescue organizations, and really, the, I guess the only limitation, if you even call it that, is that, that this is specific to Florida, but that's pretty broad in itself.
It's pretty broad, Duncan. And,
yeah.
You know, we do work with a lot of other rescues in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, if the dog can be transported before it can be a big issue, too.
Sure.
If the dog can be transported easily and is available in Georgia and ready to go, which a lot of us have our own transportation.
Yeah.
You know, we open it up to Alabama, southern Georgia.
Cool. But, and here's another question that sort of raises in my mind is do you see it, Cindy, also at some point broadening out to cats, or is it going to remain dog specific?
I can't answer that question right now, Duncan.
Okay.
All of us have taken cats in at one point or another in
mm-hmm.
rescue.
Yeah.
But I guess every one of us get hundreds of emails a day with death row dogs. It's sickening, Duncan.
Sure.
You know, you save one and five more come along. And
right.
The cat overpopulation, I mean, there are groups out there, and am I opposed to it? No. So we're just starting out, and I think we're up to about 130 likes in 2 days, and it's been very well received by the rescue community because we all work together. But to get the public to know that is what we're trying to ultimately reach, and kind of like a one-stop shopping. You know, you go through the page and there's collies and there's German shepherds and there's heelers, and you know, it's every kind of dog possible that's available.
Right. So yeah, whatever dog you're looking to have join your family, you could find it at Adopt a New Leash on Life. And so for people, what's the best way just to search on Facebook for Adopt a New Leash on Life, or do you have a more specific shorter
Adopt
address?
A New Leash on Life. And
okay.
Come right to the page.
Okay.
Oh, right to that page.
That's great.
And, you know, we're very proud of the response it's received. We've always worked within the rescue community. And Holly Ryerson, Amy Benz, and I kind of brainstormed one day and said, you know, we need to get these Florida dogs adopted. And
yeah.
There are hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And people just aren't aware. You know, they'll go to a shelter, and I don't ever knock a breed, but, you know, you have small children, and there are pit bulls, or there are boxers, and, you know, it's not the dog that family is specifically looking for,
mm-hmm.
and we really want to encourage people, adopt, don't shop.
Great. All right, well, let's hope that more people know about it, and we'll go to find on Facebook, Adopt a New Leash on Life, and thanks so much for the cool idea, and thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Duncan, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, January 25th, with another edition. I hope you'll join us then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for He's Back! Yay! The fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3 p.m. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. In fact, we've already been hearing this highly relevant final tune underneath us. This is the Ahmad Jamal Trio with Dolphin Dance, taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. right here on Talking Animals. Thanks.